5 years ago, all the headlines were retail is dead. There is no retail. Shopping malls are going by the wayside, and we're never going to have shopping malls ever again. And there's all these dead malls that nobody wants. But you know what? People have figured out ways to repurpose them, to knock them down and build industrial on them, to renovate them, to build experiential retail. And that has completely changed the talking points. And that's what's going to happen with office. I just don't know what it's going to look like.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Grant Pruitt, who is the co-founder and president of White Box Real Estate, has over 18 years of experience in commercial real estate brokerage. He's also transacted on over $1 billion worth of real estate transactions. Grant, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. The pleasure is mine, Grant. There are three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. In 90 seconds or less, can you tell me, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
That's not 90 seconds, but I'll keep it to that. I started working for my father in San Antonio, who's also in commercial real estate, broker, developer, owner. I never wanted to get into commercial real estate, but it was literally the only thing I was good at. When I went to college, I thought it was a good way to make money on the side. Turned out that it ended up being a career. I saw an opportunity in the markets, and I ended up starting White Box Real Estate 7.5 years ago. So that's where I am. That's where I got to be. And in the future, I want to continue to grow it. And we want to be at least by the year 2030, I want to be in seven markets around the United States.
That is amazing. 7.5 years ago, you launched this firm of yours, and if I got this right off air, you said you guys are in Dallas, you're in Fort Worth, you're in Houston, and you're in DC
and Austin. We got a little office in Austin too.
And Austin, I mean, that's a lot of growth in a very short period of time.
We've been very fortunate. We made the Inc. 5000 list this year. It's can't do it without our clients, and so I really owe it to them and the people of this company.
For sure. No, absolutely, though. I think it also takes some vision and some stuff, you know, on the leadership side to even see the opportunity, which is one of the things that you mentioned. You said you saw an opportunity, I guess it's 7.5 years ago. What was the opportunity, and why was that the time to take advantage of it?
Well, in the commercial real estate world, there was a lot of consolidation, and there was a real change in the business model as I saw it, and that the consolidation ultimately was to take many of these companies public. Say 10, 12 years ago, you had a limited number of publicly traded real estate companies, specifically on the office and the industrial side, on the brokerage side. Wall Street doesn't jive with the brokerage business as well as privately held companies do, or people that are involved in privately held companies. And they started getting out of the idea of working with middle market clients, sub Fortune 200 clients, sub institutional clients. And while there was and still continues to be a great appetite to work with very large institutional groups, everybody who wasn't, that they couldn't sell four or five different service lines, was kind of left out there hanging. So I saw that as an opportunity for us to go out and take and seize that niche.
Right. So if I'm hearing you right, there's Wall Street, and you're saying that if they weren't of a certain size, Wall Street wasn't interested in it. And
correct.
You said, look, you know, I see an opportunity to start our own brokerage that really is going to service the things that maybe they aren't interested in, and there's plenty there for us to take.
Yeah, all my clients were and still continue to be. I mean, some of them are publicly traded, but for the most part, they're going to be sub Fortune 200, sub Fortune 500. You know, they're going to be good, large middle market businesses. And, you know, if you look at what is defined as a middle market business, you know, you can talk to any M&A guy and they're talking about $5, $6, $7 billion businesses being in that middle market space. Because when you look at the, you know, the big guys, you know, you're talking about at this point, a trillion-dollar valuation on Google and Amazon and Tesla, and there's a lot to be serviced that feeds a lot of mouths. It's a lot of bulk. It's a lot of volume that, you know, a boutique like us, we're not really cut out to handle. But, you know, if they have 300 locations across the United States, or if they're looking to deploy, you know, capital into real estate assets, we're a great conduit for that. That's a great client for us. And, you know, we don't have to have all their business. We just need a little bit of it.
Got it. That, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And when you're of that size, a little bit goes certainly a long way. That's so what was the first asset class you really focused on, and how did you present and get your kind of foot in the door to present that then to those companies?
I laugh because when you start a business and you start it from scratch, you're looking for anybody that will work with you.
Sure.
If they'll work with you, that's the ideal client. And fortunately, it happened to be in the industrial space. So it was a warehouse user that was the first client that I worked with. But quite frankly, if it would have been, if it would have been triple net lease buildings or retail or multifamily or just about anything that we could have transacted on, that probably would have been our first client, and we probably would have been focused on that. But fortunately, it landed in my sweet spot in the office in the industrial space.
Man, that's really cool. Yeah, I love that. But let's talk about office space. I mean, that's kind of one of those things right now that is, it's the dog everybody's kicking. And I bet you've got some insights that would say, one, why it may be a good investment now. And then maybe if you can give us a little insight into where you think office is heading. Obviously it's local,
sure.
But would love to hear kind of what you're seeing in your corner of the market.
Absolutely. So it's funny because we see it on two fronts. We're working with the tenant and the user. We're also working with the buyer and the investor. And the tenant and the user market is much more active than what people think it is. And I understand why they feel that way. And then when we talk about that from an investor standpoint, there's always a little bit of a credibility check when we're saying that we're seeing that activity. What we really see, and I think you see this across a lot of markets in the country for the office space, is you have a tale of two cities. You have your class A, class AA, very well located, highly amenitized, desirable product that does exceptionally well. And the vacancy rates are very often sub 10%. And then you have your class B and under assets that are 25-30% vacant, sometimes more than that.
Right.
And so it changes by market. And I'll point that out as well. And that, you know, I was talking to a buddy of mine in Chicago. And in Chicago, he said, well, you know, it's all the class B assets in the suburban environment that people are considering and want to be in. And I said, well, it's really what I feel is the opposite of the market that I'm in. It's the class B urban assets that have the ability to be reconfigured, that have some sort of readaptive use that you can retrofit the building as, that are more desirable. You know, in this particular market, if you're three or four streets off the main drag. And in this market, we have a lot of freeways. So if you're three or four streets off an interstate or a freeway, and you know it's a 1980s three-story, two-story atrium building that's surface parking, that's probably brown brick, that's a really, really, really tough building to own. And that's going to be a difficult building to operate. And I think that's the great unknown as to what that looks like moving forward and how we work with those assets moving forward. If you have the Class B asset that's in an urban environment, we do see a lot of change in use to hotels, multifamily, mixed use development. You know, I've even been seeing people have been talking about, I haven't seen in this market, but I probably will as soon as we get done here, you know, even doing urban farming in some of these Class B assets that are out there. So I think that you're going to see a lot of redaptive reuse type projects. But, you know, as long as it's well located, it's a Class A asset, it's doing exceptionally well. And I'll tell you the driver for that. We've had a lot of, you know, historically speaking, and this really has bucked the norm. Historically speaking, the Class B asset has been the safest asset to invest in.
Mm.
The idea was that when the market went down, the businesses were looking at ways to cut costs. So the people that were, or the tenants that were using Class A space would go to a Class B asset to save money. Right. So it stayed full. Sure. When the market did well, they moved out to a Class A asset, and the people that were in a Class C asset wanted to upgrade their space. And so they moved into a Class B asset. So it more or less was recession proof, and it always stayed leased. Fast forward to today, the tastes have changed. The work weeks have changed. And what we see is if they have 30,000 feet in a Class B asset that has, you know, 40% utilization, 50% utilization, and on Mondays and on Fridays, it's not being used, they just say, forget it. We're going to go to a Class A asset. We're going to take 10,000 square feet. The people that want to come work here, great. They can work here. The people that don't want to work here and want to work from home, great. That's fine. And by going from 30,000 to 10,000, they're going to a nicer building, but they're cutting their rent. And so it keeps those Class A, Class AA assets filled. The other thing to keep in mind, and I speak to this from a local standpoint, is in-migration and headquarters relocations. So one of the guy that runs my industrial group here in Dallas has a great analogy for in-migration to DFW. And he says, look, every day a 747 comes and lands at DFW airport and all the people get off, but they never leave. And that happens 365 days a year, where you keep having these 747s land and they get off, but they never, ever leave. And so that's how much of a population boom we're seeing.
Right.
And in addition to that, we're still seeing very significant headquarters relocating to this particular market. So I always talk about Toyota. Toyota moved here from Torrance, California. They announced it in 2014. They moved in 2016. They bought 4,000 jobs, but it wasn't the 4,000 jobs that Toyota brought. It was all the other jobs that came with Toyota to service Toyota. Right. If you go to Plano and Frisco on the northern end of the Metroplex, not so far north at this point, but at that point, very far north, they built that market. They built a city with all the companies that went there to service them. And I tell people that was 4,000 jobs. I can look out my window and I can see Goldman Sachs' new headquarters going in. They're bringing 5,000 new jobs. And if I look maybe with binoculars, not too far in Irving, as Wells Fargo, that's 3,000 new jobs. So that's 8,000 new jobs. That's twice what we saw with Toyota that have yet to come and take residence here. And that completely is going to continue to change the dynamics. So, you know, from an investor standpoint, you always talk about location, location, location. Well, where's the population growth? Where are the companies moving to? What businesses are going to need other businesses to come service them? And then what are the asset classes that are still desirable? Now, I'll back up a little bit, and I'll tell you and everybody else that I talked to. I had this conversation with an institutional family office that does real estate investing last night. I don't know what's going to happen with these Class B suburban assets. Something will. I don't know what's going to make the most sense. Whoever figures it out is going to make a lot of money. I just don't know what it is. And from a historical context, I'll give you an example of that. It doesn't take that. It's not that hard to think back. 5 years ago, all the headlines were retail is dead. There is no retail. Shopping malls are going by the wayside, and we're never ever going to have shopping malls ever again. And there's all these dead malls that nobody wants. But you know what? People have figured out ways to repurpose them, to knock them down and build industrial on them, to renovate them, to build experiential retail. And that has completely changed the talking points. And that's what's going to happen with office. I just don't know what it's going to look like.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that's it is interesting to see. I mean, shoot, here in the Memphis market, I was just, again, I'm not in the office space. I don't have any investments in office, but even just here in the Memphis market, talking about that Class B kind of asset. I was taking one of my daughters to the doctor here a couple of weeks ago, and I was driving by, and it's a Class B, late 80s build, that same brick build you're talking about. Nobody. I mean, this entire campus completely vacant. Like, it's, I mean, if I used to be in the single family foreclosure space. I'm like, this just looks like one massive 50-acre foreclosure. Like, what in the world? And it looked like a nice building. Like, if it were maintained and taken care of at some point, the investor probably just said, city, you can have it. I mean, I don't know what happened. What is happening with that? But there is a gold mine sitting there when someone figures out what to do with it.
That's right.
That's really, really wild. I love, and thank you for taking the time to break that down, because I've had, several different people talk about office, and it is either, look down upon, but you've given some real clear insight into what makes still a very compelling office investment. And it sounds like a couple of things. One is market dependent, obviously, but then type of asset within that market that, people are still looking for. So, come to you and check out what you guys have going on there in the Dallas or in Fort Worth markets to see what opportunities still are out there in the office space. I think that's really, really fascinating. We've seen kind of that on the inverse of that, though, and you said you cut your teeth on the industrial side. I mean, industrial's just been off the chain for an untold amount of time. Where is that going?
So I also think that some of that has to do with being market specific. And we are seeing, we saw unprecedented demand for 3 years, and it is quelling.
Okay.
I think it's going to continue to be strong. But take a market like Charlotte. They were seeing 13 to 15% annual rent growth. That it's unsustainable to have that. In our market, we've been seeing 10% rent growth. And when I tell people that it's quelling, I go, well, we're going to see 3 to 4% rent growth, which is extremely good for us, because this is a market that, there's some markets like east of Dallas, the Garland market. I have an uncle that's a developer as well, and he was given this talk, and he said, in the 1970s, we were developing warehouses in Garland and leasing them at $2 a foot. And he said, what rents are now? This was about 2008, 2009. He goes, $2 a foot. And so it took really 35, 40 years for us to see rental appreciation in some of these markets, because we just built so much product here in Dallas, Fort Worth. You're seeing the inverse. The industrial demand, even starting prior to COVID accelerated e-commerce, which, everybody talks about e-commerce last mile, but even prior to that, the drivers of industrial demand were onshoring of manufacturing and e-commerce. We the third driver of demand that we've seen has been increased inventory levels, which is typically about 30% increased inventory levels. I call it the toilet paper effect, that you don't want to run out of toilet paper, so you stock up on 30% more toilet paper than you need in your warehouses. The increased inventory levels more or less has played out through the system. What is continuing to play out as onshoring of manufacturing, and even more so e-commerce, because only about 17% of our retail sales are e-commerce. And I don't know about you, but my home has more Amazon boxes that show up than every day. There are more Amazon boxes that show up at my house than the day before, because we are embracing the idea of e-commerce in our household. And I think that's only going to continue to accelerate. The last mile is going to get more and more and more complex, because that speed to the rooftop, speed to market is going to become more and more important. And technology is going to enable us to be able to do that. So when I say it's market specific, we're in Dallas, Fort Worth. You can reach the majority of the country within 1,000 miles. So that's a 2-day drive for a truck driver. 1 day if you have 2 truck drivers. What changes that is automated trucking, which is here. We're going to continue to see an acceleration of different markets that grow because of what technology is inspiring. And so your question about seeing the inverse, yes, we are seeing the inverse. We're seeing spaces that were functionally obsolete that didn't lease for 30 years, that were in markets that were in the doldrums, that are now some of the hottest markets in the country. Great example is the Valwood market here in DFW. We were doing $3 gross deals on buildings that now are probably going to get $10 net. And that market went from a very undesirable market because it was smaller products, shallower bays, older product, functionally obsolete, class 4 sprinklers. And when people started trying to identify what was close to rooftops, well, I'll be darned, it is right there by all the rooftops. And, you know, Amazon has completely disrupted the distribution model. You know, if you remember 10, 15 years ago, they started with million square foot facilities in most metropolitan areas. You know, in DFW, they built 2 million square footers. And if you're, the idea of e-commerce was that you weren't going to have as much need for industrial space because it was literally going to come in and out and you weren't going to have to warehouse anything. And what happened was it did the opposite. So it grew the inventory levels and it grew the need and demand for industrial space. So then Amazon went from 1 million feet and then they started leasing 500,000 square footers. And then it went to 250s. And I'll never forget, they leased 70,000 feet in a 14 clear, completely functionally obsolete building in central Dallas. And it was like everybody that was real estate professionals' head exploded and said, why on earth are they doing that? What are they thinking? And it was because they needed a presence to be able to quickly deliver goods goods to households. And it broke the model. It absolutely broke the model. So you're going to continue to see that. But I do caution people and that everything in real estate is a pendulum. It swings this way, it swings this way, it swings this way, it swings this way. And I don't see a reason at this point in time, but there will come a day when we overbuild and we don't have a need for as much industrial space. And we're going to be having the same conversation we're having about office, but it's going to be about industrial. Because I had that conversation 15 years ago.
Isn't that the way it is, though? I mean, this is something, I was on a panel here a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about just being opportunistic in that it is the way real estate runs. Like you're saying, we're overbuilt maybe on office space right now. We went through an incredible run in the last decade on the multifamily consolidation, on just, you know, like you said, increasing rents, prices, just cap rates compressing, prices skyrocketing. And now we're seeing that cool off to a certain degree. And again, in certain markets. But I think it's one of those things where it's stay in front of that, being in tune with what's happening in the market and really staying true to fundamentals. And I'm sure it's one of the things you guys preach to your investors is really stick to your fundamentals, because not everything lasts forever on the bad side or the good side. So I think
100%.
That's really, really cool. Grant, this has been awesome having you come on the show today. You've broken down really two really key asset classes that many people are interested in, both probably on the sidelines watching office and then actively investing in on the industrial side, giving some great insight, both what's happening in your market and then also around the country. This has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you for your time. If our listeners want to get in touch with you and or your firm, what is the best way to do that?
You can go to www.whiteboxrealestate.com, or you can send us an email at contact@whiteboxrealestate.com.
Whiteboxrealestate.com. We'll make sure we include that there in the show notes. Grant, thank you again for coming on the show today. It was certainly a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.